fought to the end. In a desperate last-ditch counterattack, the Europeans eked out victory. More critical than steel to Pizarro's success was the horse. The biggest animal in the Andes during Inca times was the llama, which typically weighs 300 pounds. Horses, four times as massive, were profoundly, terribly novel. Add to this the shock of observing humans somehow astride their backs like half-bestial nightmare figures, and it is possible to imagine the dismay provoked by Pizarro's cavalry. Not only did Inca infantrymen have to overcome their initial stupefaction, their leaders had to reinvent their military tactics while in the midst of an invasion. Mounted troops were able to move at rates never encountered in Tawantinsuyu. Even when the Indians had posted pickets, Hemming observed, the Spanish cavalry could ride past them faster than the sentries could run back to warn of danger. In clash after clash, the dreaded horses proved invincible. But horses are not inherently unbeatable. The Inca simply did not discover quickly enough where they had an advantage, on their roads. European-style roads, constructed with horses and cars in mind, view flatness as a virtue. To go up a steep hill, they use switchbacks to make the route as horizontal as possible. Inca roads, by contrast, were built for llamas. Llamas prefer the coolness of high altitudes and, unlike horses, readily go up and down steps. As a result, Inca roads eschewed valley bottoms and used long stone stairways to climb up steep hills directly, brutal on horses' hooves, as the conquistadors often complained. Traversing the foothills to Cajamarca, Francisco Pizarro's younger brother, Hernando, lamented that the route, a perfectly good Inca highway, was so bad that the Spanish could not use horses on the roads, not even with skill. Instead, the conquistadors had to dismount and lead their reluctant animals through the steppes. At that point, they were vulnerable. Late in the day, Inca soldiers learned to wait above and roll boulders on their foes, killing some of the animals and frightening others into running away. Men left behind could be picked off at leisure. Multiple ambushes cost the lives of many Spanish troops and animals. To be sure, horses confer an advantage on flat ground. But even on the plains, the Inca could have won. Foot soldiers have often drubbed mounted troops. At the Battle of Marathon in 490 BC, the outnumbered, out-armored Athenian infantry destroyed the cavalry of the Persian Emperor Darius I. More than 6,000 Persians died. The Greeks lost fewer than 200 men. So dire had the situation initially appeared that before the fight, Athens sent a messenger to Sparta, its hated rival, to beg for aid. In the original Marathon, the courier ran more than 100 miles in 2 days to deliver his message. But by the time the Spartan reinforcements arrived, there was nothing to see but dead Persians. The Inca losses were not foreordained. Their military was hampered by the cult of personality around its deified generals, which meant both that leaders were not easily replaced when they were killed or captured, and that innovation in the lower ranks was not encouraged. And the army never learned to bunch its troops into tight formations, as the Greeks did at Marathon, forming human masses that can literally stand up to cavalry. Nonetheless, by the time of the siege of Cuzco, the Inca had developed an effective anti-cavalry tactic, bolas. The Inca bola consisted of 3 stones tied to lengths of a llama tendon. Soldiers threw them, stones a whirl, at charging horses. The weapons wrapped themselves around the animal's legs and brought them down to be killed by volleys of sling missiles. Had the bolas come in massed, coordinated onslaughts instead of being wielded by individual soldiers as they thought opportune, Pizarro might well have met his match. If not technology or the horse, what defeated the Inca? As I said, some of the blame should be heaped on the overly centralized Inca command structure, a problem that has plagued armies throughout time. But another much larger part of the answer was first stated firmly by Henry Dobbins. During his extracurricular reading about Peru, he came across a passage by Pedro Cieza de Leon, the Spanish traveler who observed three roads between the same two cities. Entranced by the first exhibition of Inca booty in Spain, Cieza de Leon had crossed the Atlantic as a teenager and spent 15 years in Peru, Bolivia, Ecuador, and Colombia, traveling, fighting, and taking notes for what would become a massive three-volume survey of the region. Only the first part was printed in his lifetime. But by the 20th century, historians had found and published most of the rest. Dobbins learned something from Cieza de Leon that was not mentioned in Prescott's history. In the Smithsonian's official handbook of South American Indians, or in any of the then-standard descriptions of Tawantinsuyu. According to Cieza de Leon, Huayna Capac, Atahualpa's father, died when a great plague of smallpox broke out in 1524 or 1525, so severe that more than 200,000 died of it, for it spread to all parts of the kingdom. Smallpox not only killed Huayna Capac, it killed his son and designated heir, and his brother, uncle, and sister-wife. The main generals and much of the officer corps died, wrote the Inca chronicler, Santa Cruz Pachacuti Yamqui Salcamayhua. All their faces covered with scabs. So did the two regions left in Cusco by Huayna Capac to administer the empire. After the dying, Huayna Capac locked himself away so that nobody could see his pustulous face. Salcamayhua reported, he was visited by a terrifying midnight vision. Surrounding him in his dream were millions upon millions of men. The Inca asked who they were. Souls of the lost, the multitude told him. All of them would die from the pestilence, each and every one. The story is probably apocryphal, but its import isn't. Smallpox has an incubation period of about 12 days, during which time sufferers, who may not know they are sick, can infect anyone they meet. With its fine roads and great population movements, Tawantinsuyu was perfectly positioned for a major epidemic. Smallpox radiated throughout the empire like ink spreading through tissue paper. Millions of people simultaneously experienced its symptoms: high fever, vomiting, severe pain, oozing blisters everywhere on the body. Unable to number the losses, the Jesuit Martin de Marua said only that the toll was infinite thousands. The smallpox virus is generally thought to have evolved from one of two closely related viruses. Camelpox virus, which as the name suggests, affects domestic camels, or taterpox virus, which is found in Kemp's gerbil, a West African rodent that is considered an agricultural pest. The virus's name comes from the gerbil's former scientific name, Tatera kempi. The idea is that about 15,000 years ago, a chance mutation let the virus jump the species barrier, as scientists say, and infect human beings. Neither the camel nor the gerbil existed in the Americas, so the disease never had a chance to exist there. In Europe, Asia, and Africa, smallpox became a constant, terrible presence, infecting almost every child, killing many, and leaving others with the disfiguring pockmarks that are its telltale sign. Survivors become immune to the disease. Because most Europeans contracted the disease in childhood, the great majority of European adults, the conquistadors among them, were immune. Indians, by contrast, had never been exposed to it. They were, in a second bit of scientific jargon, virgin soil. Virgin soil death rates for smallpox are hard to establish because for the last century, most potential research subjects have been vaccinated. But a study in the early 1960s of 7,000 unvaccinated smallpox cases in southern India found that the disease killed 43% of its victims. Noting the extreme vulnerability of Andean populations, they would not even have known to quarantine victims as Europeans had. Dobbins hypothesized that the empire's population may well have been halved during this epidemic. In about 3 years, that is, as many as one out of two people in Tawantinsuyu died. The human and social costs are beyond measure. Such overwhelming traumas tear at the bonds that hold cultures together. The epidemic that struck Athens in 430 BC, Thucydides reported, enveloped the city in a great degree of lawlessness. The people became contemptuous of everything, both sacred and profane. They joined ecstatic cults and allowed sick refugees to desecrate the great temples, where they died untended. 1,000 years later, the Black Death shook Europe to its foundations. Martin Luther's rebellion against Rome was a grandson of the plague, as was modern anti-Semitism. Landowners' fields were emptied by death, forcing them either to work peasants harder or pay more to attract new labor. Both choices led to social unrest. The Jacquerie, France, 1358. The Revolt of Ciompi, Florence, 1378. The Peasants' Revolt, England, 1381. The Catalonian Rebellion, Spain, 1395. And dozens of flare-ups in the German states. Is it necessary to spell out that societies mired in fratricidal chaos are vulnerable to conquest? To borrow a trope from the historian Alfred Crosby, if Genghis Khan had arrived with the Black Death, this book would not be written in a European language. As for Tawantin Suyu, smallpox wiped out Wina Kapak and his court, which led to civil war as the survivors contested the spoils. The soldiers who died in the battle between Atahualpa and Huashcar were as much victims of smallpox as those who died from the virus itself. The ferocity of the civil war was exacerbated by the epidemic's impact on a peculiarly Andean institution, royal mummies. People in Andean societies viewed themselves as belonging to family lineages. Europeans did too, but lineages were more important in the Andes. The pop cultural comparison might be The Lord of the Rings, in which characters introduce themselves as X, son of Y, or A, of B's line. Royal lineages, called Panaka, were special. Each new emperor was born in one Panaka, but created a new one when he took the fringe. To the new Panaka belonged the Inca and his wives and children, along with his retainers and advisors. When the Inca died, his Panaka mummified his body. Because the Inca was believed to be an immortal deity, his mummy was treated, logically enough, as if it were still living. Soon after arriving in Cusco, Pizarro's companion, Miguel de Estete, saw a parade of defunct emperors. They were brought out on litters, seated on their thrones and surrounded by pages and women with fly whisks in their hands, who ministered to them with as much respect as if they had been alive. Because the royal mummies were not considered dead, their successors obviously could not inherit their wealth. Each Inca's Panaka retained all of his possessions forever, including his palaces, residences, and shrines. All of his remaining clothes, eating utensils, fingernail parings, and hair clippings, and the tribute from the land he had conquered. In consequence, as Pedro Pizarro realized, the greater part of the people, treasure, expenses, and vices in Tawantin Suyu were under the control of the dead. The mummies spoke through female mediums who represented the Panaka's surviving courtiers or their descendants. With almost a dozen immortal emperors jostling for position, high-level Inca society was characterized by Ramos political intrigue of a scale that would have delighted the Medici. Emblematically, Huayna Capac could not construct his own villa on Aucaipata. His undead ancestors had used up all the available space. Inca society had a serious mummy problem. After smallpox wiped out much of the political elite, each Panaka tried to move into the vacuum, stoking the passions of the civil war. Different mummies at different times backed different claimants to the Inca throne. After Atahualpa's victory, his Panaka took the mummy of Tupa Inca from its palace and burned it outside Cusco. Burned it alive, so to speak. And later, Atahualpa instructed his men to seize the gold for his ransom, as much as possible from the possessions of another enemy Panaka, that of Pachacuti's mummy. Huashcar's Panaka kept the civil war going even after his death, or rather, non-death. While Atahualpa was imprisoned, Huashcar's Panaka sent one of his younger brothers, Tupahualpa, to Cajamarca. In a surreptitious meeting with Pizarro, Tupahualpa proclaimed that he was Huashcar's legitimate heir. Pizarro hid him in his own quarters. Soon afterward, the Lord of Cajamarca, who had backed Huáscar in the Civil War, told the Spanish that Atahualpa's army was on the move, tens of thousands strong. Its generals planned to attack Pizarro, he said, and free the emperor. Atahualpa denied the charge truthfully. Pizarro, nonetheless, ordered him to be bound. Some of the Spaniards most sympathetic to Atahualpa asked to investigate. Soon after they left, two Inca ran to Pizarro, claiming that they had just fled from the invading army. Pizarro hurriedly convoked a military tribunal, which quickly sentenced the Inca to execution. The theory apparently being that the approaching army would not attack if its leader were dead. Too late, the Spanish expedition came back to report that no Inca army was on the move. Tupahualpa emerged from hiding and was awarded the fringe as the new Inca. The execution, according to John Rowe, the Berkeley archaeologist, was the result of a conspiracy among Pizarro, Tupahualpa, and the Lord of Cajamarca. By ridding himself of Atahualpa and taking on Tupahualpa, Rowe argued, Pizarro had exchanged an unwilling hostage for a friend and ally. In fact, Tupahualpa openly swore allegiance to Spain. To him, the oath was a small price to pay. By siding with Pizarro, Huáscar's Panaca, which had lost everything, had a chance again. Apparently the new Inca hoped to return with Pizarro to Cusco, where he might be able to seize the wheel of state. After that, perhaps, he could wipe out the Spaniards. On the way to Cusco, Pizarro met his first important resistance near the river town of Hachunsosa, which had been overrun by Atahualpa's army during the Civil War. The same force had returned there to battle the Spanish, but the Inca army's plan to burn down the town and prevent the invaders from crossing the river was foiled by the native Sosa and Huanca populace, which had long resented the empire. Not only did they fight the Inca, they followed the old adage about the enemy of my enemy being my friend and actually furnished supplies to Pizarro. After the battle, Tupahualpa suddenly died, so suddenly that many Spaniards believed he had been poisoned. The leading suspect was Chalcochima, one of Atahualpa's generals, whom Pizarro had captured at Cajamarca and brought along on his expedition to Cusco. Chalcochima may not have murdered Tupahualpa, but he certainly used the death to try to persuade Pizarro that the next Inca should be one of Atahualpa's sons, not anyone associated with Huáscar. Meanwhile, Huáscar's Panaca sent out yet another brother, Manco Inca. He promised that if he were chosen to succeed Tupahualpa, he would swear the same oath of allegiance to Spain. In return, he asked Pizarro to kill Chalcochima. Pizarro agreed, and the Spaniards publicly burned Chalcochima to death in the main plaza of the next town they came to. Then they rode toward Cusco. To Dobbins, the moral of this story was clear. The Inca, he wrote in his 1963 article, were not defeated by steel and horses, but by disease and factionalism. In this, he was echoing conclusions drawn centuries before by Pedro Pizarro. Had Huayna Capac been alive when we Spaniards entered this land, the conquistador remarked, it would have been impossible for us to win it. And likewise, had the land not been divided by the smallpox-induced civil wars, we would not have been able to enter or win the land. Pizarro's words, Dobbins realized, applied beyond Tawantinsuyu. He had studied demographic records in both Peru and southern Arizona. In both, as in New England, epidemic disease arrived before the first successful colonists. When the Europeans actually arrived, the battered, fragmented cultures could not unite to resist the incursion. Instead, one party, believing that it was about to lose the struggle for dominance, allied with the invaders to improve its position. The alliance was often successful, in that the party gained the desired advantage. But its success was usually temporary, and the culture as a whole always lost. Between the 16th and 18th centuries, this pattern occurred again and again in the Americas. It was a kind of master narrative of post-contact history. In fact, Europeans routinely lost when they could not take advantage of disease and political fragmentation. Conquistadors tried to take Florida half a dozen times between 1510 and 1560, and failed each time. In 1532, King João III of Portugal divided the coast of Brazil into 14 provinces and dispatched colonists to each one. By 1550, only two settlements survived. The French were barely able to sustain trading posts in the St. Lawrence and didn't even try to plant their flag in pre-epidemic New England. European microorganisms were slow to penetrate the Yucatan Peninsula, where most of the Maya polities were too small to readily play off against each other. In consequence, Spain never fully subdued the Maya. The Zapatista rebellion that convulsed southern Mexico in the 1990s was merely the most recent battle in an episodic colonial war that began in the 16th century. All of this was important, the stuff of historians' arguments and doctoral dissertations, but Dobbins was thinking of something else. If Pizarro had been amazed by the size of Tawantinsuyu after the terrible epidemic and war, how many people had been living there to begin with? Beyond that, what was the population of the Western Hemisphere in 1491? An arithmetical progression. Huayna Capac died in the first smallpox epidemic. The virus struck Tawantinsuyu again in 1533, 1535, 1558, and 1565. Each time the consequences were beyond the imagination of our fortunate age. They died by scores and hundreds, recalled one eyewitness to the 1565 outbreak. Villages were depopulated. Corpses were scattered over the fields or piled up in the houses or huts. The fields were uncultivated, the herds were untended, and the price of food rose to such an extent that many persons found it beyond their reach. They escaped the foul disease, but only to be wasted by famine. In addition, Tawantinsuyu was invaded by other European pestilences, to which the Indians were equally susceptible. Typhus, probably, in 1546, influenza in 1558, together with smallpox, diphtheria in 1614, measles in 1618, all flensed the remains of Inca culture. Taken as a whole, Dobbins thought, the epidemics must have killed 9 out of 10 of the inhabitants of Tawantinsuyu. Dobbins was not the first to arrive at this horrific conclusion, but he was the first modern researcher to put it together with the fact that smallpox visited before anyone in South America had even seen Europeans. The most likely source of the virus, Dobbins realized, was the Caribbean. Smallpox was recorded to have appeared on the island of Hispaniola in November or December 1518. It killed a third of the native population before jumping to Puerto Rico and Cuba. Spaniards exposed in childhood to the virus were mostly immune. During Hernán Cortés's conquest of Mexico, an expedition led by Pánfilo de Narváez landed on April 23, 1520, near what is today the city of Veracruz. According to several Spanish accounts, the force included an African slave named Francisco Eguia or Baguia who had smallpox. Other reports say that the carriers were Cuban Indians whom Narváez had brought as auxiliaries. In any case, someone brought the virus and infected a hemisphere. The disease raced to Tenochtitlan, leading city of the Mexica, Aztecs, where it laid waste to the metropolis and then the rest of the empire. From there, Dobbins discovered, colonial accounts show smallpox hopscotching through Central America to Panama. At that point, it was only a few hundred miles from the Inca frontier. The virus seemingly crossed a gap with catastrophic consequences. Then Dobbins went further. When microbes arrived in the Western Hemisphere, he argued, they must have swept from the coastlines first visited by Europeans to inland areas populated by Indians who had never seen a white person. Colonial writers knew that disease tilled the virgin soil of the Americas countless times in the 16th century, But what they did not, could not know, is that the epidemics shot out like ghastly arrows from the limited areas they saw to every corner of the hemisphere, wreaking destruction in places that never appeared in the European historical record. The first whites to explore many parts of the Americas, therefore, would have encountered places that were already depopulated. As a result, Dobbin said, all colonial population estimates were too low. Many of them, put together just after epidemics, would have represented population nadirs, not approximations of pre-contact numbers. From a few incidents in which before and after totals are known with relative certainty, Dobbins calculated that in the first 130 years of contact, about 95% of the people in the Americas died. To estimate native numbers before Columbus, one thus had to multiply census figures from those times by a factor of 20 or more. The results obtained by this procedure were, by historical standards, stunningly high. Historians had long wondered how many Indians lived in the Americas before contact. Debated since Columbus attempted a partial census at Hispaniola in 1496, Denevan, the Beni geographer, has written, it remains one of the great inquiries of history. Early researchers' figures were, to put it mildly, informally ascertained. Most of them weren't even ballpark calculations, Denevan told me. No ballpark was involved. Only in 1928 did the first careful estimate of the indigenous population appear. James Mooney, a distinguished ethnographer at the Smithsonian Institution, combed through colonial writings and government documents to conclude that in 1491, North America had 1.15 million inhabitants. Alfred L. Kroeber, the renowned Berkeley anthropologist, built upon Mooney's work in the 1930s. Kroeber cut back the tally still further, to 900,000, a population density of less than one person for every 6 square miles. Just 8.4 million Indians, Kroeber suggested, had lived in the entire hemisphere. Recognizing that his continent-wide estimate did not account for regional variation, Kroeber encouraged future scholars to seek out and analyze sharply localized documentary evidence. As he knew, some of his Berkeley colleagues were already making those analyses. Geographer Carl Sauer published the first modern estimate of Northwest Mexico's pre-Columbian population in 1935. Meanwhile, physiologist Sherburne F. Cook investigated the consequences of disease in the same area. Cook joined forces with Woodrow W. Borah, a Berkeley historian, in the mid-1950s. In a series of publications that stretched to the 1970s, the two men combed through colonial financial, census, and land records. Their results made Kroeber uneasy. When Columbus landed, Cook and Borah concluded, the central Mexican plateau alone had a population of 25.2 million. By contrast, Spain and Portugal together had fewer than 10 million inhabitants. Central Mexico, they said, was the most densely populated place on Earth, with more than twice as many people per square mile than China or India. Historians and anthropologists did not, however, seem to be paying much attention to Cook and Borah, Dobbins wrote. Years later, his work, coupled with that of Denevan, Crosby, and William H. McNeil, finally made them take notice. Based on their work and his own, Dobbins argued that the Indian population in 1491 was between 90 and 112 million people. Another way of saying this is that when Columbus sailed, more people lived in the Americas than in Europe. According to a 1999 estimate from the United Nations, the Earth's population in the beginning of the 16th century was about 500 million. If Dobbins was right, disease claimed the lives of 80 to 100 million Indians by the first third of the 17th century. All these numbers are at best rough approximations, but their implications are clear. The epidemics killed about one out of every five people on Earth. According to W. George Lovell, a geographer at Queen's University in Ontario, it was the greatest destruction of lives in human history. Dobbins published his conclusions in the journal Current Anthropology in 1966. They spawned rebuttals, conferences, even entire books. Denevin assembled one, the native population of the Americas in 1492. I always felt guilty about the impact of my current anthropology article, Dobbins told me, because I thought and still think that Cook and Bora and Sauer had all said this in print earlier, but people weren't listening. I'm still puzzled by the reaction, to tell you the truth. Maybe it was the time. People were prepared to listen in the 1960s. Listen and attack. Dobbins's population projections were quickly seen by some as politically motivated. Self-flagellation by guilty white liberals, or, worse, a push to inflate the toll of imperialism from the hate America crowd. No question about it, some people want those higher numbers, Shepard Kretsch III, an anthropologist at Brown, told me. These people, he said, were thrilled when Dobbins revisited the subject in a 1983 book, Their Number Become Thinned, and revised his estimates upward. Few researchers today accept Dobbins's estimates. They seem extreme. But most believe that native numbers were far higher than estimated by previous generations. Most, but not all. Vehemently arguing against Dobbins, Denevin, Crosby, Cook, and Bora was David Hennige of the University of Wisconsin, whose book, Numbers from Nowhere, published in 1998, is a landmark in the literature of demographic vilification. Suspect in 1966, it is no less suspect nowadays, Hennige charged of Dobbins's work. If anything, it is worse. Hennige stumbled across a seminar on Indian demography taught by Denevin in 1976. An epiphanic moment occurred when he read that Cook and Bora had uncovered the existence of 8 million people in Hispaniola. Can you just invent millions of people, he wondered. We can make of the historical record that there was depopulation and movement of people from internecine warfare and diseases, he said to me. But as for how much, who knows? When we start putting numbers to something like that, applying large figures like 95%, we're saying things we shouldn't say. The number implies a level of knowledge that's impossible. Indian activists reject this logic. You always hear white people trying to minimize the size of the aboriginal populations their ancestors personally displaced, according to Lenore Stiffarm, an ethnologist at the University of Saskatchewan. Dismissing the impact of disease, in her view, is simply a way to reduce the original population of the Americas. Oh, there used to be a few people there, and disease killed some of them. So by the time we got here, they were almost all gone. The smaller the number of Indians, she said, the easier it is to regard the continent as empty, and hence up for grabs. It's perfectly acceptable to move into unoccupied land, Stiffarm told me, and land with only a few savages is the next best thing. When Hennige wrote Numbers from Nowhere, the fight about pre-Columbian population had already consumed forests worth of trees. His bibliography is 90 pages long. 4 decades after Dobbins's article appeared, his colleagues are still struggling to get out of the crater that paper left in anthropology, according to James Wilson, author of Their Earth Shall Weep, a history of North America's indigenous peoples after conquest. The dispute shows no sign of abating. This is partly because of the inherent fascination with the subject. But it is also due to the growing realization of how much is at stake. Chapter 4. Frequently Asked Questions. Not enough for Yankee Stadium. On May 30th, 1539, Hernando de Soto landed his private army near Tampa Bay in Florida. De Soto was a novel figure, half warrior, half venture capitalist. He grew very rich very young in Spanish America by becoming a market leader in the nascent slave trade. The profits helped to fund the conquest of the Inca, which made De Soto wealthier still. He accompanied Pizarro to Tawantinsuyo, burnishing his reputation for brutality. He personally tortured Chalcochima, Atahualpa's chief general, before his execution. Literally looking for new worlds to conquer, De Soto returned to Spain soon after his exploits in Peru. In Charles V's court, he persuaded the bored monarch to let him loose in North America with an expedition of his own. He sailed to Florida with 600 soldiers, 200 horses, and 300 pigs. From today's perspective, it is difficult to imagine the ethical system that could justify De Soto's subsequent actions. For 4 years, his force wandered through what are now Florida, Georgia, North and South Carolina, Tennessee, Alabama, Mississippi, Arkansas, Texas, and Louisiana, looking for gold and wrecking most everything it touched. The inhabitants often fought back vigorously, but they were baffled by the Spaniards' motives and astounded by the sight and sound of horses and guns. De Soto died of fever with his expedition in ruins. Along the way, though, he managed to rape, torture, enslave, and kill countless Indians. But the worst thing he did, some researchers say, was entirely without malice. He brought pigs. According to Charles Hudson, an anthropologist at the University of Georgia, who spent 15 years reconstructing De Soto's path, the expedition built barges and crossed the Mississippi a few miles downstream from the present site of Memphis. It was a nervous time. Every afternoon, one of his force later recalled, several thousand Indian soldiers approached in canoes to within a stone's throw of the Spanish and mocked them as they labored. The Indians, painted with ochre, wore plumes of many colors, having feathered shields in their hands, with which they sheltered the oarsmen on either side, the warriors standing erect from bow to stern, holding bows and arrows. Utterly without fear, De Soto ignored the taunts and occasional volleys of arrows and pulled over the river into what is now eastern Arkansas, a land thickly set with great towns, according to the soldiers' account. Two or three of them to be seen from one. Each city protected itself with earthen walls, sizable moats, and dead-eye archers. In his brazen fashion, De Soto marched right in, demanded food, and marched out. After De Soto left, no Europeans visited this part of the Mississippi Valley for more than a century. Early in 1682, foreigners appeared again, this time Frenchmen in canoes. In one seat was René Robert Cavelier, Sieur de La Salle. La Salle passed through the area where De Soto had found cities cheek by jowl. It was deserted. The French didn't see an Indian village for 200 miles. About 50 settlements existed in the strip of the Mississippi where De Soto showed up, according to Anne Remanofsky, an archaeologist at the University of New Mexico. By La Salle's time, the number had shrunk to perhaps 10. Some probably inhabited by recent immigrants. De Soto had a privileged glimpse of an Indian world, Hudson told me. The window opened and slammed shut. When the French came in and the record opened up again, it was a transformed reality. A civilization crumbled. The question is, how did this happen? Today, most historians and anthropologists believe the culprit was disease. In the view of Remanofsky and Patricia Galloway, an anthropologist at the University of Texas, the source of contagion was very likely not De Soto's army, but its ambulatory meat locker, his 300 pigs. De Soto's company was too small to be an effective biological weapon. Sicknesses like measles and smallpox would have burned through his 600 men long before they reached the Mississippi. But that would not have been true for his pigs. Pigs were as essential to the conquistadors as horses. Spanish armies traveled in a porcine cloud, drawn by the supper trough. The lean, hungry animals circled the troops like darting dogs. Neither species regarded the arrangement as novel. They lived together in Europe for millennia. When humans and domesticated animals share quarters, they are constantly exposed to each other's microbes. Over time, mutation lets animal diseases jump to people. Avian influenza becomes human influenza. Bovine rinderpest becomes human measles. Horsepox becomes human smallpox. Unlike Europeans, Indians did not live in constant contact with many animals. They domesticated only the dog, the turkey in Mesoamerica, and the llama, the alpaca, the Muscovy duck, and the guinea pig in the Andes. In some ways, this is not surprising. The New World had fewer animal candidates for taming than the Old. Moreover, few Indians carry the gene that permits adults to digest lactose, a form of sugar abundant in milk. Non-milk drinkers, one imagines, would be less likely to work at domesticating milk-giving animals. But this is guesswork. The fact is that what scientists called zoonotic disease was little known in the Americas. By contrast, swine, mainstays of European agriculture, transmit anthrax, brucellosis, leptospirosis, trichinosis, and tuberculosis. Pigs breed exuberantly and can pass diseases to deer and turkeys, which then can infect people. Only a few of DeSoto's pigs would have had to wander off to contaminate the forest. The calamity wreaked by the DeSoto expedition, Ramanofsky and Galloway argued, extended across the whole southeast. The societies of the Caddo on the Texas-Arkansas border and the Coosa in western Georgia both disintegrated soon after. The Caddo had a taste for monumental architecture, public plazas, ceremonial platforms, mausoleums. After DeSoto's army left, the Caddo stopped erecting community centers and began digging community cemeteries. Between the visits of DeSoto and LaSalle, according to Timothy K. Pertula, an archaeological consultant in Austin, Texas, the Caddoan population fell from about 200,000 to about 8,500, a drop of nearly 96%. In the 18th century, the tally shrank further to 1,400. An equivalent loss today would reduce the population of New York City to 56,000, not enough to fill Yankee Stadium. That's one reason whites think of Indians as nomadic hunters, Russell Thornton, an anthropologist at the University of California, Los Angeles, said to me. Everything else, all the heavily populated urbanized societies, was wiped out. Could a few pigs truly wreak this much destruction? Such apocalyptic scenarios have invited skepticism since Henry Dobbins first drew them to wide attention. After all, no eyewitness accounts exist of the devastation. None of the peoples in the Southeast had any form of writing known today. Spanish and French narratives cannot be taken at face value, and in any case, say nothing substantial about disease. The belief that epidemics swept through the Southeast comes less from European accounts of the region than from the disparities among those accounts. Although the archaeological record is suggestive, it is also frustratingly incomplete. Soon after the Spaniards visited, mass graves became more common in the Southeast, but there is yet no solid proof that a single Indian in them died of a pig-transmitted disease. Asserting that DeSoto's visit caused the subsequent collapse of the Caddo and Coosa may be only the old logical fallacy of post hoc ergo propter hoc. Not only do archaeologists like Dobbins, Pertula, and Ramanofsky argue that unrecorded pandemics swept through the Americas, they claim that the diseases themselves were of unprecedented deadliness. As a rule, viruses, microbes, and parasites do not kill the majority of their victims. The pest that wipes out its host species has a bleak evolutionary future. The influenza epidemic of 1918, until AIDS, the greatest epidemic of modern times, infected tens of millions around the world, but killed fewer than 5% of its victims. Even the Black Death, a symbol of virulence, was not as deadly as these epidemics are claimed to be. The first European incursion of the Black Death, in 1347 to 51, was a classic virgin soil epidemic. Mutation had just created the pulmonary version of the bacillus Yersinia pestis. But even then, the disease killed perhaps a third of its victims. The Indians in DeSoto's path, if researchers are correct, endured losses that were anomalously greater. How could this be true? The skeptics ask. Consider, too, the Dobbins-esque procedure for recovering original population numbers, applying an assumed death rate, usually 95%, to the observed population nadir. According to Douglas H. Eubelacher, an anthropologist at the Smithsonian's National Museum of Natural History. The population nadir for Indians north of the Rio Grande was around 1900, when their numbers fell to about 500,000. Assuming a 95% death rate, which you, Blocker, a skeptic, does not, the pre-contact population of North America would have been 10 million. Go up 1% to a 96% death rate, and the figure jumps to 12.5 million, creating more than 2 million people arithmetically from a tiny increase in mortality rates. At 98%, the number bounds to 25 million. Minute changes in baseline assumptions produce wildly different results. Worse, the figures have enormous margins of error. Rudolf Zambardino, a statistician at North Staffordshire Polytechnic in England, has pointed out that the lack of direct data forces researchers into salvos of extrapolation. To approximate the population of 16th century Mexico, for example, historians have only the official counts of casados, householders, in certain areas. To calculate the total population, they must adjust that number by the estimated average number of people in each home, the estimated number of homes not headed by a casado, and thus not counted, the estimated number of casados missed by the census takers, and so on. Each one of these factors has a margin of error. Unfortunately, as Zambardino noted, the errors multiply each other and can escalate rapidly to an unacceptable magnitude. If researchers presented their estimates with the proper error bounds, he said, they would see that the spread is far too large to constitute a meaningful quantitative estimate. Extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence, scientists say. Other episodes of mass fatality are abundantly documented. The Black Death in Europe, the post-collectivization famine in the Soviet Union, even the traffic in African slaves. Much less data support the notion that old world bacteria and viruses turn the new world into an abattoir. Just one major disease, syphilis, is believed to have spread the other way, from the Americas to Europe, though this has long been controversial. Such evidence as can be found lies scribbled in the margins of European accounts. It is, as Crosby admitted, no better than impressionistic. Most of the arguments for the very large numbers have been theoretical, Ubelacher told me. But when you try to marry the theoretical arguments to the data that are available on individual groups in different regions, it's hard to find support for those numbers. Archaeologists, he said, keep searching for the settlements in which those millions of people supposedly lived. As more and more excavation is done, one would expect to see more evidence for dense populations than has thus far emerged. Dean R. Snow of Pennsylvania State repeatedly examined pre-contact sites in eastern New York and found no support for the notion that ubiquitous pandemics swept the region. In the skeptic's view, Dobbins and other high counters, as proponents of large pre-Columbian numbers have been called, are like people who discover an empty bank account and claim from its very emptiness that it once contained millions of dollars. Historians who project large Indian populations, low counter critics say, are committing the intellectual sin of arguing from silence. Given these convincing rebuttals, why have the majority of researchers nonetheless become high counters? In arguing that Indians died at anomalously high rates from European diseases, are researchers claiming that they were somehow uniquely vulnerable? Why hypothesize the existence of vast, super-deadly pandemics that seem unlike anything else in the historical record? The speed and scale of the projected losses boggle the mind, observed Colin G. Calloway, a historian at Dartmouth. One reason, he suggested, that researchers were so long reluctant to accept them. Indeed, how can one understand losses of such unparalleled scope? And if the European entrance into the Americas 5 centuries ago was responsible for them, what moral reverberations does this have today? The genetics of vulnerability. In August 1967, a missionary's 2-year-old daughter came down with measles in a village on the Tututobi River in Brazil, near the border with Venezuela. She and her family had just returned from the Amazonian city of Manaus and had been checked and cleared by Brazilian doctors before departure. Nonetheless, the distinctive spots of measles emerged a few days after the arrival on the Tututobi. The village, like many others in the region, was populated mainly by Yanomami Indians, a forest society on the Brazil-Venezuela border that is among the least westernized on Earth. They had never before encountered the measles virus. More than 150 Yanomami were in the village at the time. Most or all caught the disease. 17 died despite the horrified missionaries' best efforts, and the virus escaped and spread throughout the Yanomami heartland, carried by people who did not know they had been exposed. Partly by happenstance, the U.S. geneticist James Neal and the U.S. anthropologist Napoleon Chagnon flew into Yanomami country in the midst of the epidemic. Neal, who had long been worried about measles, was carrying several thousand doses of vaccine. Alas, the disease had preceded them. They frantically tried to create an epidemiological firebreak by vaccinating ahead of the disease. Despite their efforts, the affected villages had a mean death rate of 8.8%. Almost 1 out of 10 people died from a sickness that in Western societies was just a childhood annoyance. Later, Neal concluded that the high death rate was in part due to grief and despair, rather than the virus itself. Still, the huge toll was historically unprecedented. The implication, implausible at first glance, was that Indians in their virgin soil state were more vulnerable to European diseases than virgin soil Europeans would have been. Perhaps surprisingly, there is some scientific evidence that Native Americans were, for genetic reasons, unusually susceptible to foreign microbes and viruses. One reason that researchers believe that pandemics of Dobynsian scale and lethality could have occurred. Here I must make a distinction between two types of susceptibility. The first is the lack of acquired immunity. Immunity gained from a previous exposure to a pathogen. People who have never had chickenpox are readily infected by the virus. After they come down with the disease, their immune system trains itself, so to speak, to fight off the virus, and they never catch it again, no matter how often they are exposed. Most Europeans of the day had been exposed to smallpox as children, and those who didn't die were immune. Smallpox and other European diseases didn't exist in the Americas, and so every Indian was susceptible to them in this way. In addition to having no acquired immunity, the first kind of vulnerability, the inhabitants of the Americas had immune systems that some researchers believe were much more restricted than European immune systems. If these scientists are correct, Indians as a group had less innate ability to defend themselves against epidemic disease. The second kind of vulnerability. The combination was devastating. The second type of vulnerability stems from a quirk of history. Archaeologists dispute the timing and manner of Indians' arrival in the Americas, but almost all researchers believe that the initial number of newcomers must have been small. Their gene pool was correspondingly restricted, which meant that Indian biochemistry was, and is, unusually homogeneous. More than 9 out of 10 Native Americans, and almost all South American Indians, have type O blood, for example, whereas Europeans are more evenly split between types O and A. Evolutionarily speaking, genetic homogeneity by itself is neither good nor bad. It can be beneficial if it means that a population lacks deleterious genes. In 1491, the Americas were apparently free or almost free of cystic fibrosis, Huntington's chorea, newborn anemia, schizophrenia, asthma, and, possibly, juvenile diabetes, all of which have some genetic component. Here, a limited gene pool may have spared Indians great suffering. Genetic homogeneity can be problematic, too. In the 1960s and 1970s, Francis L. Black, a virologist at Yale, conducted safety and efficacy tests among South American Indians of a new, improved measles vaccine. During the tests, he drew blood samples from the people he vaccinated, which he later examined in the laboratory. When I telephoned Black, he told me that the results were thought-provoking. Every individual person's immune system responded robustly to the vaccine, but the native population as a whole had a very limited spectrum of responses. And that, he said, could be a real problem in the right circumstances. For Indians, those circumstances arrived with Columbus. Black was speaking of human leukocyte antigens, HLAs. Molecules inside most human cells that are key to one of the body's two main means of defense. Cells of all sorts are commonly likened to biochemical factories. Busy ferments in which dozens of mechanisms are working away in complex sequences that are half Rube Goldberg, half ballet. Like well-run factories, cells are thrifty. Part of the cellular machinery chops up and reuses anything that is floating around inside, including bits of the cell and foreign invaders such as viruses. Not all of the cut-up pieces are recycled. Some are passed on to HLAs, special molecules that transport the snippets to the surface of the cell. Outside, prowling, are white blood cells, leukocytes to researchers. Like minute scouts inspecting potential battle zones, leukocytes constantly scan cell walls for the little bits of stuff that HLAs have carried there, trying to spot anything that doesn't belong. When a leukocyte spots an anomaly, a bit of virus, say, it destroys the infected or contaminated cell immediately, which means that unless an HLA lugs an invading virus to where the leukocyte can notice it, that part of the immune system cannot know it exists, let alone attack it. HLAs carry their burdens to the surface by fitting them into a kind of slot. If the snippet doesn't fit into the slot, the HLA can't transport it, and the rest of the immune system won't be able to see it. All people have multiple types of HLA, which means that they can bring almost every potential problem to the attention of their leukocytes. Not every problem, though. No matter what his or her genetic endowment, no one person's immune system has enough different HLAs to identify every strain of every virus. Some things will always escape notice. Imagine someone sneezing in a crowded elevator, releasing into the air 10 variants of a rhinovirus, the kind of virus that causes the common cold. Viruses mutate quickly and are commonly present in the body in multiple forms, each slightly different from the others. For simplicity's sake, suppose that the other elevator passengers inhale all 10 versions of the virus. One man is lucky. He happens to have HLAs that can lock onto and carry pieces of all 10 variants to the cell surface. Because his white blood cells can identify and destroy the infected cells, this man doesn't get sick. Not so lucky is the woman next to him. She has a different set of HLAs, which are able to pick up and transport only 8 of the 10 varieties. The other 2 varieties escape the notice of her leukocytes and go on to give her a howling cold. Eventually, other immune mechanisms kick in and she recovers. These disparate outcomes illustrate the importance to a population of having multiple HLA profiles. One person's HLAs may miss a particular bug, but another person may be equipped to combat it, and the population as a whole survives. Most human groups are a scattershot mix of HLA profiles, which means that almost always some people in the group will not get sick when exposed to a particular pathogen. Indeed, if laboratory mice have too much HLA diversity, Black told me, researchers can't use them to observe the progress of an infectious disease. You get messy results. They don't all get sick. The opposite is true as well, he said. People with similar HLA profiles fall victim to the same diseases in the same way. In the 1990s, Black reviewed 36 studies of South American Indians. Not to his surprise, he discovered that overall, Indians have fewer HLA types than populations from Europe, Asia, and Africa. European populations have at least 35 main HLA classes, whereas Indian groups have no more than 17. In addition, Native American HLA profiles are dominated by an unusually small number of types. About 1/3 of South American Indians, Black discovered, have identical or near identical HLA profiles. For Africans, the figure is 1 in 200.